So thank you very much for coming. We're doing this interview about your book, The Ring of Words, Tolkien and the Oxford English Dictionary. And perhaps if I could just ask you to introduce yourselves and say what you actually do at Oxford University Press.
Well, I'm Peter Gilliver, one of the associate editors of the OED. The work I'm engaged in is revising the text of the dictionary. The dictionary was published roughly 100 years ago and has been added to ever since. But the entries in the dictionary, as originally published, are now in need of revision.
I'm Jeremy Marshall. I'm also an associate editor with the OED, and my speciality is historical biology, but I do a range of subjects around that, and sometimes some completely unrelated ones which I happen to have picked up. And so I spend most of my days thinking about science words rather than philology. But my interest in Tolkien is long-standing and deep-rooted.
I'm Edmund Viner. I'm deputy chief editor of the OED. I help the chief editor to finalise text before it's published online, so the text of each quarterly instalment is looked at by us before it's published.
Thank you very much. Perhaps we could start by asking you, what was the reason behind you, the impetus behind writing the book?
Well, we knew something about the work that Tolkien had done as a lexicographer. Some years ago I did some research in the archives here at OUP, having known through my interest in Tolkien that he had come to work on the OED, and I thought, gosh, how interesting, that's what I'm doing now. I wonder whether I can find out exactly what he did. And so the research on that brought out a picture of what he did in the years just after the First World War. And then talking to colleagues, we began to wonder about whether the fact that he had been an OED lexicographer actually influenced the way he used English. Of course, everybody knows that Tolkien was fascinated by languages, and languages of all sorts pervade his creative writing, but the ones that people know about are the invented languages, which are quite a different thing from the way he chooses to use English. And looking at the way that he uses English, as influenced by the fact that he was a philologist, somebody whose professional work was concerned with the words of the English language, and more specifically not just a philologist but a lexicographer.
It's noticeable in some of the other works than Lord of the Rings, which is particularly well known, that philology keeps cropping up, and I'm thinking particularly of Farmer Giles of Ham, which is full of very erudite jokes about the history of language, and so that's a clue to how his knowledge of language constantly played with his storytelling. In fact, in Farmer Giles of Ham, he even jokes about the OED, quoting the OED's entry for Blunderbuss, referring to the wise clerks of Oxenford, who are, of course, the editors of the OED.
You make the point in your book that he was a lexicographer through and through, and I suppose what you see as well is that there was this interchange in his life. He would move between lexicography and writing, but it was almost a blur. He saw himself as both. Is that right?
Yes. Very much so. And often he would think of problems in his invented languages, for example, and then try and write stories to explain how it was that such and such a word came about.
I can't remember the exact quotation, but I know on one occasion he said that his whole enterprise in creating Middle-earth and the languages and the culture and the mythology that goes with that was he wanted to create a world in which one person could greet another by saying Elensila lumen omen tielvo, which is a line for a star shines on the place of our meeting.
The hour of our meeting.
The hour of our meeting, which is an invented phrase in Elvish, but it wasn't good enough for him just to invent words that meant a star shines on the hour of our meeting. He had to explain why a star would be the important thing that one person greeting another might talk about, and what was the etymology of the words. And so while another creative writer, another fantasy writer, might invent invented words, invented languages, Tolkien's reasons for doing it were much more intimately bound up with the whole creative process. Mm-hmm. You created the world at the same time that you create the language.
The book is structured in, we'll come on to the second half where you go through individual words and discuss them in some detail, but at the beginning you talk about his career at OUP. And it might be just interesting to just say a few words about that, because I would think many readers of Lord of the Rings probably aren't that aware of his academic career, lecturing, but also his work at OUP. So he started here, as you said, after the First World War.
It was his first job. He studied here at Oxford and studied, one of his tutors was William Craigie, who was at that time one of the editors of the dictionary. And when he left active service at the end of the war, he wrote to his former tutor in Oxford, not quite saying "Giz a job," but nevertheless he was wondering what he was going to do with the next stage of his life. And he was always grateful in later years to, as he put it, the kindness of William Craigie to a demobbed soldier. He came to Oxford and was quite soon taken on working on the OED because they needed somebody like Tolkien. In 1918, when he wrote to Craigie, the dictionary was nearly finished. The first edition of the dictionary was nearly finished. They had already done X, Y, and Z. Bits of W and U were still to be done. The letter U is not the most interesting letter for a lexicographer because an awful lot of it is words beginning with un, which are not very interesting or particularly demanding, whereas the letter W is full of interest and difficulty because it's full of words which have come into English from the Germanic languages, Anglo-Saxon, and the languages of modern Germany and the Low Countries. That was exactly the area in which Tolkien had shown such promise as an undergraduate, and Craigie knew about that, and I guess when he was contacted by Tolkien, he thought, well, I know we're coming up to W, we're going to need somebody like him. And so in early 1919, he started work. Not working for Craigie, but working for Henry Bradley, one of the other editors of the OED, because it was Bradley and his staff who were just tackling the letter W.
So it was a natural fit in that sense from his studies at Oxford. But I think you also talk about the fact that he was quite interested in languages from an early age and in playing about with creating languages and creating words.
Oh, he had been a sort of amateur lexicographer from childhood, when he wrote about this in later years as a secret vice, the vice of making up languages for fun. And he made them up with his childhood friends, and they started out as very simple, nonsensical languages, but quite soon he wanted to do more than just invent a secret language that he could use with his friends. He would compile dictionaries which showed not just what words meant, but how they related to one another, where they came from. So he had that lexicographical impulse, lexicographical stroke, philological stroke, interest in the history of the languages he was concerned with from an early age.
So what exactly would Tolkien have done in his time at OUP? Your book is full of illustrations of some of the slips, which you probably still have in the archives. But imagine a sort of typical day-to-day activity for Tolkien. What was he asked to do?
He would be confronted with a huge pile of little pieces of paper. Everything was written on little pieces of paper right down to the late 1980s. The first process in historical lexicography really is sifting through the evidence that's been collected by your readers with a keyword on the top left and a sentence with a bibliographical reference. You have to decide how you're going to order this huge array of uses of a word, sort them into piles effectively, and then decide how to describe the meaning of each particular use of the word and how to illustrate its historical development by a selection of quotations from the pile you've got.
Yeah, for example, if we took the word wan, as in pale and wan, W-A-N, we know it today as a word that means pale, but at various stages in the past, the word has also meant dark. And all of the readers who had collected the evidence for the OED and sent in these slips of paper will have written out quotations illustrating the word wan. Tolkien first has to look through those and decide what the different meanings are, and as Jeremy says, arrange them in piles and write a definition for each pile, each subsense, and decide how they fit together. If this is a word that has a history, it must have started out meaning one thing and ended up meaning something else. How did it get from A to B?
And of course he would bring his knowledge of the texts he'd studied in Old English and Old Norse to sort of help sort of come up with some earlier quotations or citations for the word.
I think that his knowledge of the Old English and Middle English literature meant, for example, that he wasn't distracted by the resemblance of old meanings of words to new ones. It's very tempting when reading a Middle English text to read in the modern meaning of a word into a word which is in fact used to mean something slightly different or sometimes quite radically different in medieval language. And he would have been very much aware of that shift in sense, which happens not only within English, but then within the Germanic languages as a group, so that you may be perfectly aware, for example, that a word in Gothic is related to a word in English, but didn't mean the same in Gothic as it does now in modern English, but it might have meant something similar to what it meant in Old High German or in Old Norse. And so that kind of historical awareness of the way in which language shifts is key to being able to put together a historical dictionary entry as opposed to simply a dictionary of current meanings.
Even at that early stage, we talked earlier about the blurring between his lives, his careers. There's an example you mentioned about when he's working on a particular word, and you can see that in the Lay of the Children of Hurin. He's beginning to use the language in his own fiction, his own poetry.
I think there are many influences. Already, he's a young man, but he's already read a lot. And so, for example, the word One Hope, W-A-N-H-O-P-E, which means despair. Hope we still have, and one is a bit like un in early English. Yes, he might have encountered the word One Hope in the files of the dictionaries, because he was working on words beginning with W-A, mainly. His first word was, I think, waggle. But he may also have encountered it, it's quite likely he did encounter it, in some of the fiction that he read himself. There's William Morris, the great archaizing writer whose writings, books like The Roots of the Mountains and The House of the Wolfings, they're full of language which is deliberately chosen by William Morris to create this atmosphere of archaism, this old world atmosphere. And One Hope is a word that William Morris uses, and we know that Tolkien read a lot of William Morris, and perhaps that's what he was drawing on, as well as the piles of slips around him in the dictionary room in the Old Ashmolean.
Yes, I was very struck at one point in your book, you talk about the emergence of archaism and how Tolkien, although he's been criticised for that by many people, they find almost his text impenetrable, like the Silmarillion, you were able to demonstrate that there was a purpose behind this. It was a particular context where he moved into archaic expressions.
Yes, Tolkien was very good at layering his language so that you get different senses of historical period through the kinds of vocabulary that he's using. If you just look at the list of words we cover in the book, there are some which are very definitely antique, Old Norse, mythological terms. A word like Dwimmerleg or even dwarf has its roots in mythology. But a word like nasturtium or olifant, they're less old and they give a feeling of less distance, and they hark back more to the chivalric medieval period.
It's like an artist's palette. At different points in the text, you want to give it different colours. And I think compared to these other archaizing writers, Tolkien had more control of his palette. If he wanted to write plain narrative text telling a story about very ordinary hobbits, then the text would be plain. But if he was writing about the deeds of the high and the great kings and the heroes and so on, then the archaisms he would introduce them into the language to create that impression. And he manages to do it much more seamlessly than some of the other authors, Edmund, that I know that you looked at in researching the book, the authors of the generations before Tolkien, who could find these early words and dig them up and stick them in their text.
Yes, to George Dasent and his translations of Norse sagas. Actually, the translations are really quite racy, like the sagas themselves, but every now and then there's a few words of quite archaic English which have been almost gratuitously introduced. People will suddenly speak in a kind of old-style diction in the middle of a very fluent and current bit of English.
Yeah, I've got a bit of one of Dasent's stories here, which we quote in the book. There was a bad harvest that year in the land, yet Gunnhilda gave Hrut as much meal as he chose to have, and now he busks him to sail out to Iceland. Most of that is absolutely fine, and then you suddenly hear this word, busks him, yes. Which, if you know your sources, I'm not sure exactly where it comes from, but it's an archaic term. And he's just introduced it as if to give a sprinkling of oldie-worldiness to his narrative, which is not the way Tolkien would have...
Not at all, no, it does nothing for the narrative at all, because prepared himself or got ready would have done perfectly well. When Tolkien chose a word, it would be for an effect. I mean, it might be because he needs a particular word to express a concept in the world he's writing about, which doesn't exist otherwise, and many of the words in our last section are about that. Or he'll use it, as Peter said earlier, for the purposes of heightening the narrative, of making a sense that higher, more noble actions or thoughts are involved rather than more pedestrian, everyday ones.
It also influenced the syntax, I think, if you look at some of the courtly speech in something like the Council of Elrond.
Yes.
The syntax there is archaic almost, certainly to a modern eye.
It's more formal, but it's not archaic in the way that you will find in with someone like William Morris, where you just stumble over it. It either becomes laughable or it just becomes completely incomprehensible. And I don't think that happens certainly not in the sort of the mature Tolkien. There may be bits like that in his earlier works, but he's really purged them out as he's gone on. And in fact, when you read the History of Middle-earth and you look at the different versions of things, you can see it being purged.
And in fact, the Council of Elrond is a spectacular example of this mixing of different registers, and this great meeting of high kings and noble figures and these ordinary prosaic hobbits. And Tolkien has imagined what it's like for these people to have a conversation. They did speak the same language, but they used it in very different ways. So Elrond, a high elf, uses language in a way that's more full of archaic language, but he can still talk to a hobbit like Frodo, who replies to him in ordinary English. And it all fits together. And in the text, you'll just get one person's speech after another, with very little in the way of introductory language. And you can tell what kind of person is doing the speaking because of the language that they're given. Different registers shifting. It's a real kind of tour de force of different narrative registers.
Mm. It's an extraordinary chapter because of the way it tells it. The story is unveiled. I think Tom Shippey talks about that if you ever set that down in front of a creative writing class, they'd say, this is how you should never write a chapter where you're revealing plot, because it keeps going back and then revealing a bit more. But the use of the language is also quite startling. Mm. Moving on to the third part of the book, you have a selection of words and phrases which you choose to analyse in some depth. And I was interested how you went about selecting those to begin with, which ones you were going to look at.
Writing lists, basically. Thinking of words, reading through chunks of Tolkien and thinking, oh, that's an interesting word, maybe we've got something to say about that.
It's interesting, when we were talking about this just the other day, we became conscious of how there are, of course, words which are right under the spotlight, words which, as soon as you read a bit of Lord of the Rings or one of the other books, you know this is a Tolkienian word. Ent, of course, the name of a whole different species, hobbit, you know, these are words that are right there. You know that they're exotic. And those words went on our list straight away. Of course, you know that there's a long and interesting history about how Tolkien came to decide that Ent meant what it does mean. But as you read and reread the Tolkien texts, you notice that he uses less obvious words. He's taken just as much care over other words in the text that just seem to pass by, and taken the sort of care that a philologist would take.
When you looked at those, the patterns that emerged, were they the ones you expected in terms mainly from the Germanic languages that was his major influence?
Yes, I think that's largely true. He was completely at home and happy and in his element, you might say, in the ancient Germanic world. One of the obvious influences is Old English literature, Beowulf and similar poetry. But actually, at least equal is the literature of written in Old Icelandic or Old Norse, where the words on which he's drawn are Scandinavian words. So he has, as it were, converted them into the form they would have had they been borrowed into English, which becomes quite an interesting pattern.
For example, Edmund, I don't know if this is a good example, Eleventy.
It is a good example.
Where,
yes.
Of course, anybody who knows English can humorously go 80, 90, 10-ty, 11-ty, and that's kind of a funny thing to do, a playful thing to do. But if you also know that in Icelandic, or at least in a dictionary of Old Norse. Mm.
It's both Old English, because there is an Old English word with a prefix, but it is essentially 11-ty. But there is also a parallel word in Icelandic. And those would have been sufficient for us to imagine that Tolkien, or to understand the process by which he he coined the word 11T, but in fact the word was used in a standard dictionary of Icelandic, which I'm quite sure that Tolkien used daily. So it probably met his eye there, perhaps at a very early stage, and just stayed in the back of his mind until suddenly he needed it and brought it out. We don't really know, but that would be my guess. Because there are one or two other similar words where the same kind of thing has happened.
It's curious, though, that you could see why he might use words, particularly from an Old English origin, with the Rohirrim. But he does feel at liberty, for example, with the Hobbits, to have words there which have their etymological roots going back into the Germanic. Although the whole book's written in English, so you could say, well, a lot of it comes from that.
Yes.
He was quite free at mixing up the etymological roots for the different races.
Well,
he's also aware of English dialect, which in many cases does carry words from Norse origins into later use that haven't passed into standard English. So if you're attempting to write dialect or dialect-tinged English in an authentic way, then often you will find that these slightly odd words will creep in, because they do persist in dialect in a way that they haven't in the standard language. I think that's why some of the relatively obscure words that just kind of sneak into the narrative are there, because they represent another layer of English history.
But I'm not sure I agree that he was quite so free-handed as you seem to suggest with drawing on English from different periods, because yes, he drew on English and roots and word elements from different periods, but he was careful about what he did with them. So some of the words that are used by the hobbits have their roots in earlier periods of English, but he has taken those words and imagined, here is a word which pretty much died out in modern English, but if it had survived, would it be spelt slightly differently? Would it have changed in meaning or spelling? And that's what he does. So they fit in the modern English that the hobbits speak, whereas the Rohirrim, who are so closely modelled on Anglo-Saxon or people who speak Old English, some of the words they use are unchanged Old English. So the standard word for a battalion of horsemen is an Eorid, which is a word that was used in exactly that form in Old English.
Yes, he's doing this. It's part of the layering process. He's doing this, again, to create the impression of depth of time, to create the feeling that if the reader's viewpoint is close to the hobbit's viewpoint, they are encountering the Rohirrim, who they experience as a slightly more ancient society, speaking a slightly older version of the same language. And so he has used Old English to represent that earlier stage of the language. And so their name for themselves, Hobbit, they meet the king of Rohan, referring to them as Hobbitla, which is the invented Old English equivalent of the word. Doesn't actually exist in Old English, but he's kind of reverse engineered the word. And this occurs with a number of words that they say. So it's not a kind of random groping for old sounding words, which you do find in a lot of historical fantasy. People sort of just grab a Celtic sounding word from here and, you know, some other word from another language. It's all very carefully organized to represent the whole historical development of his world.
And consistency mattered enormously to him. If, for whatever reason, he found himself using a word or a name because he thought it was rather a nice one, that wasn't good enough. He had to make it fit and give it an etymological explanation. And actually, this is one of the things that I think Tom Shippey has captured really well in his writing about Tolkien as a philologist and a writer, is the idea of asterisk reality. When an etymologist is exploring the earlier history of a word, one of the things that you find yourself doing is imagining what form that word might have had at an earlier stage in the language. And if you don't actually have any documentation, then you will write down the form of the word, but conventionally you put an asterisk in front of it to indicate this is a reconstructed form that we don't actually have documentation for, but we suppose existed. And etymologists have to do more than this. It's no good just imagining what form the word might have had, but what was the world, the milieu in which that word was used? So you imagine the context in which people would have used that word, and Shippey has given the name of asterisk reality to this imagining.
Okay, perhaps you could let us know if there are any particular words that you found which you think deserve particular interest. Draw out a bit more about their explanation, their roots.
One that's interesting, we deal with Tolkien's word pipeweed, which he effectively invented as a mock English coinage. It's different from the way he deals with potato. With tobacco and potato, both of them are American imports, and so they don't fit into the kind of late 19th century English world that he constructs for the hobbits as his sort of medium for explaining the Middle Earth to the reader. But he deals with them in different ways. Potato, he doesn't have anything particularly he wants to do with potato, but they're part of the ethos of the Shire. So he just calls them taters, using the sort of dialect word, and rushes on through, and it just becomes part of the scenario. But tobacco, he obviously decided that just calling it baccy wasn't going to do, because he wanted to make a thing of pipeweed and the fact that the hobbits had this habit of blowing smoke rings or whatever. And so he, rather than trying to hide the etymology of the exotic word, he creates a completely new English coinage, but a plausible one, a one that's modelled on the kinds of words that you would have had in late 19th century English speech. So it sits quite naturally into the context of modern English.
And in fact, not only is it a plausible word for tobacco, pipeweed, it turns out that Tolkien didn't actually invent it at all. The work that we've done at the OED on the history of the word pipeweed shows that we can trace it back to 1792 in an American magazine. Weed is an ordinary English word, pipe is an ordinary English word. You put a weed in a pipe, you might call it pipeweed. So it's not really surprising that somebody else had the same idea. But this is an example of the layer of words, and in fact pipeweed is to some extent in the spotlight, but it's not a very crucial part of the world in the way that orc or ent or hobbit is. And there are quite a lot of these compounds that occur in Tolkien's vocabulary which just pass you by, because the process of forming compounds in English is a constant everyday process. So at one point the men of Minas Tirith eat a day meal, which is a meal that you eat at the end of the day. It's a perfectly ordinary compound of day and meal. It's just that nobody's used the word in that way, and Tolkien decides it's a nice, unobtrusive, but a bit different word that you can use to create the sense that even in the everyday, even in the ordinary things like what meals do you have in the course of a day, that you can use a word that doesn't actually occur, that sense of being shifted to another context. Lock holes. If we want to talk about the sort of the local jail, we call it the lockup. We don't call it the lock holes, but of course hobbits lived in holes. If lock hole has been used at all in English, I think it means something more like
keyhole.
But he thought, well, we can make a little joke here, and a little pun that holes are what hobbits live in, and so that the jail they have is the lock holes. Again, rather more prominently, whey bread. Bread that you eat en route. Whey bread is actually an English word that means it's kind of plantain.
It's a plant, and the key thing is that the bread in the name of the plant doesn't actually mean bread. It's a relative of the word broad, and it refers to the wide leaves of the plant.
But this is something that this act of looking at a word and actually getting distracted from what the word means in its existing context. Perhaps Tolkien came across the word waybread, again another of the words beginning with W that might have been being worked on while he was working on the OED, or maybe he just read it in a... he was quite keen on plant names, folk names for plants, and he may just have come across it and then thought, well, if you've got the compound waybread, this is what a lexicographer might do, being thoughtful about the nature of that word. Whey plus bread, what might that mean? And here, in this case, it gave rise to a whole concept, the idea of this sustaining substance that keeps you going on long journeys. That's absolutely not what the word meant, but it's as soon as you read about people being given whey bread, it hardly needs any explanation, but it becomes more and more significant as a concept.
It's an example of the kind of construction that is more familiar perhaps with his invented languages, where he would come up with a word and then write part of his story such that the word comes to exist. But he also does that with the English words, and he's playing with folk etymology. Ordinarily, folk etymology is hearsay about how a word came about, and it's almost invariably untrue. But Tolkien plays with folk etymology by writing a story about a world in which the word does actually mean that.
Mm.
Again, come back to Farmer Giles of Ham, where he explains that the village of Worminghall is called Worminghall because there was a dragon, a worm in medieval language. Of course, that's not why the village in Oxfordshire is called that, but he's decided that he can write a story to explain a sort of alternative history of the word.
I suppose the other example is if we look at the Old English word Earendel, which appears in Cynulf's poem, Christ 2, I think it is, and he wanted to try and explain what that word was and comes up with the character Earendel the Mariner.
That's right. He's picked up a word. It hasn't got much of a history in the real world, but he wants it to have one, so he creates one for it. And he does similar things, for example, with Wingelot, the name of the boat in stories of Wade the Giant. And he writes it into his mythology, as he did with Earendel. He writes it into his Quenya and Sindarin philology so that it acquires an etymology in Elvish that it didn't have in Europe.
The longest entry in the book is for the word hobbit, which is perhaps not surprising. I wonder if you could take us through the analysis you did of that word.
Not to go into all the detail, but I think the thing that really strikes you about the word is it's a complete exception to all the other words that we talk about pretty well, because the whole thesis of the book really is Tolkien's skill in taking words from the past or from various different kinds of English or indeed related languages and adapting them, crafting them, fine-tuning them in various ways to make them part of the vocabulary that he wants to use in his writings. Hobbit, he seems to have pulled out of a hat, really. It's not clear whether he really did invent it. He obviously wasn't quite sure whether he invented it, and there were various assertions about it having existed before made at the time, to which he responded rather ambiguously, and it was never really settled in his lifetime. But the fact is, it seems to be very different from his other words. Then there is the whole question of the fact that after his death, it was discovered in a folklore source and seems to go back, or does indeed go back, to this collection of tracts by the 19th century antiquarian M.A. Denham, who never really wrote a book, but simply used to collect up interesting scraps of information into these tracts which he issued and had printed and passed around his friends. The particular tract in question was reissued several times, and the whole tract is really just a list of supernatural beings, and Hobbit appears added in the third version of the tract at the head of the most recent list of words. And this tract was then reprinted in a folklore journal in 1895, which it's possible that Tolkien could have seen, or one of his friends could have seen and passed to him. It just isn't typical of the kinds of things we knew he looked at. If there had been other words in the list which were very unusual and which Tolkien had used, we might have had a clue that he did definitely see it, but in fact there aren't any pointers like that. And in any case, if he had seen this tract, the problem then simply becomes another mystery. Where did Denham get the word hobbit? Because it hasn't been traced anywhere else, and Denham was clearly simply going around combing folklore sources, dialect sources, old stories, and that kind of thing, and simply, in a very uncritical way, gathering words together. He certainly didn't seem to be inventing them. Perhaps it was even just a misprint or something. There are several other words that begin H-O-B, which refer to sort of goblin-type characters, like hobgoblin. They're all ultimately go back to the name Robin, with a change of the R to H. So it's an interesting word because it's wrapped up in these various levels of mystery, and because it runs counter to the way most of his other words were formed.
I was very struck by one of the comments you make about that Tolkien was really of that first generation of authors who could actually go back to the Oxford English Dictionary, could use it. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on how that did influence those writers, and obviously with particular focus on Tolkien.
It's certainly true that he was of that generation which had this resource that hadn't been available before, and also probably less prominently the English Dialect Dictionary, which was published at the beginning of the 20th century. There was a strong tradition of archaising writing and the use of exotic old vocabulary that went back into not only the writers of fairy story, the transcribers of fairy story, also the translators of exotic literature. Things like translations of the Arabian Nights would use this high vocabulary to give a flavour of what they were trying to convey. But after the publication of the OED, there was, in a sense, a way into vocabulary that there hadn't been before. And some authors probably picked up on this directly. We've commented on the way in which Tolkien, of course, in his intimate work with the dictionary, may have picked up words as he went along. And there are other authors, E.R. Edison comes to mind, for example, who was very much keyed to the language of a particular period. He was a devotee of Jacobean drama and uses it constantly in his writings. But there are occasions on which I've done this myself. You find an unusual word in Edison and you look it up in the OED and you find that not only is it in the OED, but that the sentence that the OED uses to illustrate it is paralleled in Edison's own text, which makes me wonder whether he'd actually found the word in the OED and woven it into his text. There are some where he clearly has found it in the original Jacobean sources and done the same thing.
Of course, there are authors of previous generations who must have found words in dictionaries. The OED wasn't the first dictionary to provide writers with that kind of resource. But the OED, and as Jeremy says, the English Dialect Dictionary, gave a much greater richness. But it's interesting to see how different authors of this generation have used that resource in different ways. Auden, in his poetry, clearly ransacked from time to time, ransacked the OED and found wonderful words that he thought he could embed in a poem. But the way he does that is completely different from the way that Tolkien takes up a word and gives it a whole context. And again, Edison, differently. It's a resource which people are just learning how they might use. And of course, using a dictionary in this way, it's not what the OED was written for at all, but it's another creative resource that writers can turn to.
I'm struck by the title of your book, The Ring of Words, with this almost circular activity with Tolkien inputting into the OED, but at the same time using it as a resource to influence his own writing. The final part of your book is about the legacy of Tolkien, and you comment on other writers who have reused some of the phrases and terms and the compounds that he came up with. I was wondering if you could just say a few words about that.
Well, it's very well known that Tolkien, after having published his books in the mid-50s, suddenly made it on the American college circuit in the 60s, and the books became immensely well known and fed into a growing interest in medieval revival, historical reconstruction, fantasy of all kinds. And he was simply a very influential writer in the field. You could go so far as to say that any fantasy writer who isn't or doesn't acknowledge an influence of Tolkien must have made a deliberate and conscious effort not to be influenced by Tolkien.
Because it's, in so many ways, it's the way that you write fantasy, or has been the way you write fantasy. There are other ways to do it, but it's a very widespread way of writing fantasy. And not just fantasy, because you get science fiction writers as well, who, I think even before Tolkien, will have had a tradition of borrowing each other's language. If one science fiction writer invents a concept which catches on, then other writers writing about the same concept in their science fiction milieu may use the same word. And it can even happen across fantasy and science fiction, because many people who read science fiction also read fantasy and vice versa. I think a wonderful example of Spock Must Die, which is a Star Trek novel written by a quite distinguished science fiction writer called James Blish. And there's a reference in it to a collection of duplicate mathems. Yeah. Matham being one of the words that Tolkien revived from Old English. In Old English it meant a piece of treasure, a valuable object, and by the time the hobbits, as it were, came to use it, it was a trinket, it was just something you couldn't bring yourself to throw away. And it was so widely understood, as Jeremy says, it was such a, Lord of the Rings was such a popular book amongst James Blish's audience, that he could just use the word Matham in a completely different context and expect his readers, without explanation, without a footnote, to understand what a collection of duplicate Mathams were. And there's some evidence that's a word which has begun to spread beyond science fiction stroke fantasy into a wider milieu. There's The Bone People, a Booker Prize-winning novel published in 1983. Kerry Hume, she uses the word Matham, and computer magazines could use the word Matham. It's the thing is, it can only catch on outside this limited context if it fills a semantic gap. Words for beasties like, you know, ants and so on, if you're going to write about an ant, it's because you're writing about the sort of world in which ants exist, whereas mavens are much more widely applicable. So that's the sort of word that has a chance of catching on beyond the fantasy milieu.
A word we didn't put into our list of words because it seemed such an obvious compound was Loremaster, either coined or popularised by Tolkien, and now it seems, I'm not a reader of fantasy generally, but it seems to me that practically any self-respecting fantasy world has a Loremaster or two dotted around somewhere in there.
What would the dictionary do if a word came into common usage which we trace back to one of Tolkien's made-up languages?
We've done it.
It's happened. There is, in fact, an entry in the dictionary for Mithril, and which is his invented silvery, strong metal. And it was used often enough by people writing about and around Tolkien that the editors of the supplement to the OED decided that it was actually worth putting it into the dictionary. And it has to be described as an invented word. And we don't go into the ins and outs of the invented etymology that Tolkien created for it, because as far as English lexicography is concerned, it's still an invention. But that would be the case with any word that did become sufficiently common. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are other creative writers who invent words and they eventually get into the dictionary. Lewis Carroll is the most prominent example, but there are other authors who've done that. And so it would just feed into the dictionary in the same way that other invented language has done.
Since the publication of the book, we have looked around at other sources and come up with further thoughts that would go into a second edition, and we have spoken.
There's a paper coming out from the Exeter College. We've more or less said what there is to say from this perspective. We're trying to act as almost a primary source. We haven't gone and read everything that's ever been written about Tolkien's use of English. We've tried to come at it afresh so that we're not simply parroting what other writers have said about Tolkien's use of language, but have tried to come to it on our own.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, Jeremy and Edmund. That's been fascinating. And the book is entitled The Ring of Words, Tolkien and the Oxford English Dictionary, published, not surprisingly, by Oxford University Press, and is available from all good bookshops and websites. Thank you.